how to start?
Well, you know, it's just writing. I mean,
here's something important to remember about dialogue.
Every word matters.
No, it doesn't.
They're vital.
I want to go to this place that I think it needs to go to.
The only thing that counts is what you see on the screen.
I will write like 4, 5, 6 hours a day.
And it will be a voice made of ink and rage.
Okay, I'm really glad you asked me that question.
Welcome back to the show. In this episode, I sat down with actor and director Stephen Moyer. He's probably best known for his portrayal as the vampire on HBO's True Blood as Bill Compton. We talked about how he got his career started in London, how he transitioned from television to film, starring in productions like Quills and 88 Minutes. We also talk about his trajectory as an actor, what it was like working with Michael Caine, everyone he got to work with early on in the movie Quills, his time at True Blood, how he got to direct, even though at the time they said no actor would ever get to direct on that show. And of course, we talk about his new film with Anna Paquin, A Bit of Light. Here's my conversation with Stephen Moyer.
I'd been doing school plays and I joined like community theater and I just loved it all. And I was also a sportsman. I didn't know what I was going to do, but there was this point in my life where I suddenly went to my parents and nobody in our family did this. Nobody in the school I went to that was a normal state school did this. I turned around and I said, I want to be an actor. And even my careers advisor at the time back in 1980, whatever it was, they had this big room full of like filing cabinets and he couldn't find anything about being an actor in all the filing cabinets. So it was not normal where I was from to do this. And I ended up going to the library and applying to a bunch of drama schools. And then I went from talking like that, like a little Essex boy, to having a very nice, like made up accent because they didn't like my accent when I got to drama school.
Back then, what were you leaning towards? Like, it seems like you're going more towards like stage work or theater as opposed to film and TV. When did you kind of start to make that shift? When did you see that opportunity?
That's really true. And the funny thing is, Brock, that because of where I was from, it never even occurred to me that I would do film or television. I'd started doing musicals and then I wanted to do plays. I started my own theater company so that I could do plays. I went to drama school to study theater, came out of drama school, went to the National Theater of Wales, and then I went to the Royal Shakespeare Company, fully expecting that that was going to be what my life was. And then 6 months after leaving drama school, I was selling Doritos in Hamburg, you know, in a commercial. And then I was selling coffee to Swedes, and I was selling Audis and playing like the young son in a sitcom. So it changed. It wasn't that I looked for it, but I can tell you right now that paying the bills was far easier with a television job or a Doritos commercial than it was doing political theater in a church basement in Paddington.
In those early days, did you find joy from all of it? Obviously, there's a paycheck, but like, how do you think about just shifting from those different jobs, like back and forth? What do you personally get out of it?
That's a really good question. I'm going to jump forward and then I'll go backwards. In 1999, I did a film directed by Philip Kaufman called Quills with Jeffrey Rush and Michael Caine and Joaquin Phoenix and Kate Winslet, and I had a really nice part in it, and it was a good script, and I was standing next to one of my heroes, Michael Caine, and this big horse-drawn carriage was thundering towards us, and we were standing watching it come towards us, and he went, "Can you believe that this is what we do for a living?" And I looked up at him and I could sense that he still had the wonder that I had. I couldn't believe that where I was from and what I had done up until that point had led me to that place where I was having that moment of joy, and he was still having that moment of joy. And when I first started, I remember the first job I got, I went to the National Theatre of Wales, as I was saying, and I was in the main house there, and it was a Christmas show. We were doing Oliver the musical. And I was just so excited to be getting paid to do what I had studied to do. I think I was on 220 quid a week for that. And in the Black Box Theatre next to us in Mold in Wales, they were doing a production of Hamlet. In that production, Rhys Ifans was playing Rosencrantz, Toby Jones was playing Osric, and Jack Davenport was playing one of the boys who brought in, like, he was 17 when he did it, Jack. It's a dear friend of mine. And they were in the Black Box and they were being paid 220 quid a week. And it was all their first jobs too, right? And the fact that we were like, the fact that you'd go up for auditions back in those days, and when you got the yes, that feeling of excitement, the belief, just like, it's yes, there is definitely this thing of like, I'm going to be able to pay the bills this month, but you're getting to do the thing that you want to do. I went and did a year at the Royal Shakespeare Company straight after that, although that's not strictly true. There were a few months there where I finished in January and I didn't start the RSC until May, so there's 3 months of unemployment. So when you do the audition and you get the job, like, you will have done 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 auditions during that time, and you're just trying to get a gig and you're just trying to get anything to keep it going. That excitement of the yes, that elation is just huge. I still have it. Sometimes an offer will come in and you just can't believe that, that somebody wants you to go and do this thing that they've, that's creative and artistic and is a realization of their vision, right? So I still get that that bounce of happiness when I get a gig.
When you're working with someone like Michael Caine that you've looked up to, he wrote a book on acting that's as specific as
books,
as specific as like which eye to use, looking at the camera and things like that. Mm-hmm. Are you thinking about things you'd like to ask him, or are you just listening? Like, how do you kind of think about the time in between takes?
These are really good questions, Brock. I remember very, very well sitting at the table read for that job. And Joaquin was quite new at the time. And because I'd come from like the RSC and that sort of world where you enunciate and you sort of perform, you know, Joaquin had his head down in his script and was just mumbling all the way through the the read through, because that was how he, to him it was just getting the words out and saying the words out loud. And I remember just like sitting there going, God, Geoffrey Rush had just like done Shine, right? And he was like Oscar winner, and it was just full of like crazy people in there that day. And I had been positioned next to Michael, and I was so couldn't believe that I was there. And Michael was going, I can't hear what he's saying. Could you hear what he's saying? Is that my cue? And the fact that he was just even talking to me, I couldn't believe it. I have told this story before, but there was this moment where he would do this thing that I know a couple of people do and I've stolen from him. When a take starts and something goes wrong immediately, right? So the director will go, and action. And somebody comes through the door and they can't get the handle to work or something. And so they go, and cut. Michael always said, was there any of that we could have used? Every single time. So if somebody said, hello, I'd just like to, oh, I'm sorry, can I do that again? Was there any of that we could have used? Just as a joke, right? So he absolutely has this sort of sense of fun in everything that he was always able to like switch off and then switch it back on again. So I was able to sort of ask him questions. One thing that I was very sort of surprised about was that he was a massive cricket fan. I know that sounds just absurd to Americans, like the idea of like people even wanting to watch cricket, but there's this game that is played between Australia and England every 2 years called the Ashes. And every 2 years, it's either in Australia or it's in England. And at that time when we were shooting, it was in Australia. So not only was it at a different time, but it was impossible to see. We were in the middle of the countryside. But I, for some reason, at some point, Michael had started talking about cricket. And I went, you like cricket, Michael? It was like, I love it. What do you think that satellite dish is doing on the top of my trailer? And I went, what are you doing? What? He said, I'm recording it. Then at lunchtime, I go and watch it on fast forward. So he said, you should come over and watch it. So I was like, oh my God. So I ended up with my food, my lunch on my lap in Michael's trailer on a daily basis. A cricket match lasts 5 days. I'm sure, I don't know if you know that. And sitting with him with food on my lap, watching the television, not wanting to disturb him and his joy, but just finding myself asking every single question I could possibly ask. But he also, whilst he was sitting with his food on his lap, watching the telly, was asking me questions about my life. What have you been working on? What are you up to? What do you want to do with your life? You know, and so having a conversation with somebody like that where they're as interested in you as you are in them is extraordinary. You know, I said to him at one point, the last thing I saw you do was Little Voice, and he was Oscar nominated for that, you know. And I said, I saw you do Little Voice and I thought you were wonderful in it. And he had a piece of food on his fork and he went, and he was watching the cricket and he went, yeah, I thought I was going to get a little statuette for that fucker. And then he put the food in his mouth. And then, you know, two or three years later, I found myself working with Donald Sutherland, and equally, Donald and I got on really, really well. And he's kind of terrifying, and yet when you get too close to him, you know, he's just wonderful. And he too would invite me into his trailer, and he would ask me about my life, and I found that just shocking that they would be interested, you know. Once somebody sort of does something disarming like that, you feel that you can ask them about what they're interested in, mm-hmm. you know.
If you think about going from that film to, like, let's say True Blood, were there any false beliefs you had about acting, either the way you studied or performed or anything like that, anything that changed drastically where you were just like maybe wrong about some degree of acting or something like that?
I can say this. I think that when I started out, I was very conscious of, when I went to drama school, I think I was probably too immature to go to drama school, or I didn't have a good enough sense of who I was that I was able to appreciate when you're asked to be a tree blowing in the wind, or a, you know, a lily pad on a pond, or a rat in a basement, or whatever it is that you're being asked to do. I always thought when I became those things that people were looking at me going, look at that fucking idiot, he's doing it. I always thought that there was somebody, and there would have been as well from my year, there would have been somebody going, look, he's taking it seriously, the dick, you know. And so I always had this sense that if I close my eyes and I go to that place and I open them quickly and I look at the audience, they're all going, he's fucking doing it, you know? And so when I first saw people sort of practicing method or a different methodology to what I had, I always felt slightly embarrassed because I thought that everybody was gonna turn around and go, look at them, they're doing this thing. So when I first started working and I came across all these different methods, especially with American actors, I probably looked down on it is the wrong way, but it's just the easiest way of explaining what I mean. I couldn't believe that people were confident enough to do their method in front of somebody without worrying about what people thought about them, right? So by the time I had traveled on this journey and I'd got to that period of time in my life, I had completely changed as a grown up. I was 37 when I got that gig, and I arrived on that job with a completely different head on my shoulders to the one that had started out, which was anybody can do whatever the fuck they want, and it's their process. You don't have to get in the way of their process, and they don't have to get in the way of your process. I truly believe that whatever anybody needs to do to get to the place that they need to get to do what they need to do is absolutely perfect. It's the perfect thing for them. And usually when you've been working with somebody for a long while, or somebody's been working in the business for a long while, they've worked out what they need to do to get there, you know? And so I think that job for me was I had already arrived at that point. So I just, whatever anybody needed to do to reach the place of performance was just totally cool. And what that meant was that no, and it was such a perfect cast and such a perfect sense of play within that production that anybody could do anything and everybody would react to it. It was like being in a sort of theater company, you know, and we'd got like Chris Bauer and Carrie Preston and Mischa Forbes, people who had been, Anna, who had been Sam Trammell, who had been all done, Broadway theater and improvs, and David Mamet, and all of these people had done all of this work. And so they'd all worked out what their methodology was. And so by the time I got there, I knew what my methodology was. And there was this confluence of like just everybody being ready for the thing. And Alan is such a sort of wonderful puppet master and playmaker and a and you know with the real essence of play being with a capital P being part of what you did. It was sort of like the perfect playground.
So
Did I
I'm
answer
looking
your
at,
question?
yeah,
Well,
yeah, yeah. I'm giving you some tough ones. So I appreciate all your
I
thoughtful
like it.
answers.
Great.
So I'm looking at IMDb. So fill in any places where we're missing something. But I believe that was where you started directing. You did a couple episodes. What made you either feel confident or that was the right time to like take that on as well?
I had started my own theatre company when I was younger, and I directed a few plays. I directed something at the Fringe for the Royal Shakespeare Company that then got taken, and we did a professional production of that. I, at that point, had thought that at some point in the next couple of years there would be another play that I would take on. And in like 96, 97, I directed a couple of shorts, and I just absolutely thought at some point that that was going to happen. But as my acting career had sort of taken off and I was making a living, it just didn't come around naturally. So when I was doing True Blood, Alan had called me into his office at the end of the first season, and he'd said to me, "Have you enjoyed the season?" I said, "Yeah, it's been unbelievable." And he said, "Is there anything that you think I'm missing?" I was like, "What do you mean?" It's like, "Is there anything that you think that I'm missing with your character?" And I sort of came up with a couple of things that if I'd died, when I was 34, 35, and then I'd got a chance to live again, I'd go out and like explore like all the music that I'd missed, all the languages that I'd missed, all the art that I'd missed. And he sort of went, "I like that. I'm going to run with that." Little did I know that that meant that when I came back, I was going to be a fan of like Cambodian disco dancing and Tuvan throat singing. But that's where Alan took it, right? But at that meeting, he said, "Is there anything you want to ask of me?" And this was at the end of the first season. And I said, "Well, I've had my own theatre company. I've directed a bunch of plays. And I wondered if," and he went, "No." And I went, "Right." He went, You're not directing." And I was like, "Right." And he basically said, "I've never let any actor touch any of my work, and I never will." And I went, "Right. Okay. Great. Good chat." And then at the end of the second year, he called me in again for the same meeting. "How have you enjoyed the season? How's it gone? Are you happy? How do you think that we coped with the things that you asked and et cetera, et cetera?" And this time he said, "Is there anything you want to ask of me?" And I said, "I know that you're going to say no to me directing. That's okay. I've got my head around that. How would you feel about me shadowing somebody in season three?" And he looked at me and he was like, "Okay." So I shadowed in three. In four, they let me go and watch the post process. I went and watched for a month, watched sound, watched mixing, watched editing, watched like final dubs and all of the online and the offline. And then in season five, he got me in and he said, "Gonna give you an episode." And so finally I was allowed to do it. And then after that, they gave me the season premieres. So I'd obviously sort of done something okay-ish. And I'm sort of forever in his debt, really, because he gave me the confidence to go out there and do it. And obviously, when you have a group of crew like we had on that were the same crew that we'd had from the pilot onwards, it's such a family. And that first episode that I directed, it was like I was being carried on a cushion, by them. There was a lot of love in that group.
So tell me a little about like what stood out about the story of A Bit of Light, and then how do you approach directing differently? Like directing a series, you're coming in and matching a style for the most part. How do you kind of present your style with something like that?
I sort of go about it via the material. I knew when I did The Parting Glass that we were going to do all handheld. Me and Guy Godfrey, the DP, decided on The Parting Glass that it was all going to be handheld, that at all times we would be with the actors, with them, walking with them, moving with them, as if we were part of the group that were on that road trip. With this, Pete Alabone and I, the DP, had talked about lots of different stylistic choices, but one of which was we wanted the flashbacks to feel different to the present day. What I was attracted to in the story was the idea of this woman who is so broken by her own behavior, her own destructive behavior, that she feels invisible. She spends her time going to the park where she used to take her children to play. I didn't say this, but she's lost custody of her kids. She goes to the park to watch other children play in the park that she used to take her children to punish herself for her previous behavior. And she's invisible and broken, but there's a kid there who's also by himself, who doesn't seem to have any parents with him, who sees her, and he makes it his quest to put her back together like a piece of Lego, you know, to rebuild her and make her ready for her children again. And I just thought it was such a beautiful idea that anybody in any situation, in any circumstance that they're in, has somebody watching them who is offering a hand if the person is prepared to take it. I just thought it was such a wonderful idea, written by a very dear old friend of mine, and that she'd won an award for it as a play. And I thought it would be an amazing role for Anna. And we were very lucky to get the amazing Ray Winston to play her dad. And I thought it was a role that we wouldn't have seen Ray do before, playing this gentle, broken human himself. And the boy, Neil, played by newcomer Luca Hogan, is this kid who sort of, yes, takes it upon himself to rebuild her, but everybody he comes into contact with, he touches in some way, and he sort of is the bit of light that is the title. He offers a hand to everybody he sees and guides them somehow. And so I sort of, even though it's a really difficult subject matter, I saw great hope in that idea.
From your acting background, are there things you do differently as a director? The way you talk to actors or set up a scene or even day one, anything like that comes to mind?
The first thing that I say when I get onto set, so I just directed the final two episodes of Sexy Beast, right, for Paramount Plus. And I had been working with all of those crew and all of those actors as an actor for the first, you know, 4 or 5 months of that gig. And the first thing that I say whenever I get to a set is, there are no bad ideas. This is an open door policy. I am just a small cog in the wheel. We are all in exactly the same situation. Everybody has a say. If you think that you have a better shot than the one that I'm setting up, tell me. If I don't receive that idea very well at the time because I'm under stress, it doesn't mean that it's not a good idea. And it doesn't mean that I won't come back to it. It's just that we're driven by time. I try to set up a set that is full of love and warmth and creativity. So if Brad, the focus puller, goes like, hey, Steve, look at this shot, look at this over here. And I've got the camera pointing here, and he and I just do that. And there's maybe the sun is like catching a piece of, it's coming off a window in the background, right? That might only happen for that 2 minutes because of the way that the sun's hitting the light. Like, I will go, move the camera, boys, get it over there. Brad, thank you, bam. Because ultimately, you're empowering the crew to feel like they are in the creative process too. Mm-hmm. I love that. And in terms of how I speak to actors, I try to think of ways of saying to actors, I try to be as obtuse as possible to get to the place that I need to be. But I can tell you right now, as an actor, sometimes I will turn to the director and just say it how you want me to say it. Just tell me what you want me to say. Give me a line reading like that. Because sometimes you just can't hear it in your head.
Hmm.
So if an actor turns around, if I'm trying to explain something and an actor goes, just say the fucking words how you want me to say it. Honestly, sometimes that shorthand can be really helpful. Anna and I have a shorthand where sometimes she'll do a take and I'll be about to step in and she'll just go, got it, I know what you're going to say. And she'll do the thing that I was going to say. Mm-hmm. There is a sort of telepathic sort of sense of, you know, sometimes though she'll go, I'm lost, give me an idea. And I'll just go in and I'll go, what about... She's saying you didn't just make a telepath comment about to a journalist when that's basically what Sookie was in True Blood. I'm sorry. As I said it, I thought that's going to get picked up on. there is sometimes I can just go in and say one word to Anna and she'll go, yep, good, walk away, you know, and I will. But sometimes we'll sit and we'll talk about what we want. We'll stop for a minute and we'll go, what are we trying to do here? What's the point? What's she going through that we're not exploring? What is not coming across that I think I'm doing that I need to do, right? Mm-hmm. And so we'll talk about what that might look like. And that's just the beauty of creation, you know, that is trying to sort of feel that essence hit the lens.
Thanks so much for tuning into the show. Before you take off, I want to give you a free gift. I'm giving you my first book, Ink by the Barrel, for free. That's the digital download and audiobook at brockswenson.com. Inside this book, you'll learn how to annihilate writer's block by embracing Elizabeth Gilbert's playful trickster mentality. You can learn to weaponize your anxiety with Kevin Kelly's Different is Better approach. And learn how to defend your time with Ryan Holiday's calendar anorexia mindset. There's just a few other ideas in the book, Ink by the Barrel. It's also based on over 400 interviews I've done right here on Creative Principles. So go steal that book right now, Ink by the Barrel, to learn how to be a prolific writer. You can get your copy, that's digital download and audiobook, at brockswinson.com, brockswinson.com. And if it's your first time here, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Make sure to hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode.